Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey folks, how you doing? Hope it's all going well. This is Ben, you're listening to episode 88 of my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Many thanks for joining me as usual and welcome along. My chat this week, which I very much enjoyed having, is with the Swiss photographer and Seven Photos member, Daniel Schwartz. Before I introduce Daniel properly, a few bits of housekeeping and an exciting announcement from the sponsors of this episode and many other episodes, the ever wonderful Charcoal Book Club. If you enjoy this podcast and you think it's worth the price of a cup of coffee per episode, then please do sign up for a small recurring monthly subscription, or if you prefer, make a larger occasional donation at bensmithphoto.com/a small voice. Do please leave a positive review on iTunes so that others may find out about it. And if you should happen to be in need of a new website because your current one is just not up to scratch, but you can't face sorting that all out yourself, I will happily do the whole thing for you using the Squarespace platform for a very competitive rate. Also, I'm very pleased to let you all know that the Charcoal Book Club have announced that the third annual Chico Hot Springs Portfolio Review and Charcoal Publishing Prize is open for entries now until the 10th of December. You can submit now by going to charcoalbookclub.com and clicking on Portfolio Review in the top left corner. If you aren't familiar with this event, the Chico Review, which will take place at the end of March 2019, is a juried photo book retreat that takes place over 6 nights at Chico Hot Springs Resort near Livingston in Montana. 45 photographers will be selected by the jury and invited to spend the week taking part in portfolio reviews, artist lectures, panel discussions, and getting together over drinks in the saloon and the hot springs. The all-star panel of speakers and reviewers will include Todd Heido, Mark Steinmetz, Andrea Modica, Alex Webb, Rebecca Norris-Webb, Aperture, Pier 24 Photography, Chose Commune, TBW Books, and many others. Not only is this a rare chance to showcase your projects and workshop ideas with some of the best in the business, but one grand prize winner will receive the coveted Charcoal Publishing Prize, which means one lucky photographer will earn the right to be published and distributed worldwide by Charcoal Book Club. So the whole thing looks like it's going to be awesome. The venue alone looks like it's worth going for. It's in Paradise Valley, for goodness sake. And happily, yours truly will be in attendance as an invited media partner. I'll be hosting a couple of panels. I'll be talking to as many people as possible, looking at work, of course, hopefully getting some podcast chats in the can with some of the aforementioned photographers, hanging out in hot springs, probably getting quite drunk on high-quality American wine. And the whole shebang will, of course, be recorded for a special Small Voice episode. So submit now by going to charcoalbookclub.com and clicking on Portfolio Review in the top left corner. And while you're there, check out this month's book of the month, Half Story, Half Life by Raymond Meeks, curated by Ron Jude. I love getting these books, and recently they've been sending surprise prints from the curators in addition to the book. They keep finding little ways to add value. So if you love photo books, join the club, use the code A Small Voice to claim a free book of your choice when you do. So Daniel Schwartz concentrates on book projects with exhibitions based on extensive travels, photographic essays and reportages covering the Eastern Hemisphere from Iran to East Timor and from Turkmenistan to Bangladesh. Daniel's art, as he puts it, is in the history of places, and his journalism, rather than being a reaction to events, builds on memory. His method is perhaps best expressed in Travelling Through the Eye of History, published in 2009, like all his books by Thames and Hudson, a pre- and post-9/11 observation covering Central Asia, including Afghanistan, Pakistan and Kashmir. In 1987 to 1988, during a forbidden journey, Daniel became the first foreigner and photographer to travel along all sections of the Great Wall of China, which he talks a little bit about. His documentation of the habitats of South and Southeast Asia's deltas, endangered by the consequences of climate change, were an early photojournalistic investigation investigation into that subject, celebrated by the Financial Times as a visual jacques, and made him twice a finalist of the W. Eugene Smith Grant in Humanistic Photography. He continues to work on the subject of climate change for While the Fires Burn, A Glacier Odyssey, his exploration of the recession of the world's glaciers. Such an interesting, smart, well-travelled, well-read bloke is Daniel. Love talking to him. Just listen, you'll see what I mean. How was Fair London for you?
Well, like any fair, it's about vanity and egos, and it's a market.
Yeah, I hear that said a lot, and I think that is generally the photographer's experience. I don't think many photographers particularly enjoy it, but it seems like a necessary evil for some people if you're in the business of selling prints.
It is. I mean, it's the information value you have. You see what the vintage print goes at, what price, etc., you know, and you see these things which are so pretentious, you know, and usually the price tag is accordingly. But you discover here and there, you discover something.
Did you see any work that you liked?
Yeah, well, I made a small discovery. Basically, actually, it was a great discovery. There was a block of Polaroids by Guy Bourdin, you know, from the 50s and 60s, sort of. I mean, they were exhibited hilariously on the light in the pavilion, you know. I mean, they should have been protected by by a black cloth.
Yeah, so they're degrading as we speak.
They're degrading. Basically, it was a work in progress. But they were really great. Each and every frame, I think it was a block of 6x6 frames, so about 2 dozen. Each of them, great.
That's really interesting, because he was sort of renowned as kind of a fashion photographer, really, wasn't he?
Well, you know, at one point, it just has to be a gripping image, you know.
And right,
the
right.
The label really doesn't matter. But you could say that some of them were surreal. You could see really where he comes from, that he has seen the surrealist work, or at least he was aware of them, you know. And there was a book published lately, last year, I think, by Steidl, show his very, very early work from the 50s. I mean, that's like sort of, you could have seen that, you know, in magazines like Minotaur or Verve, you know, if they would have existed still at his time.
That's interesting.
So that was a really nice discovery.
Did you look at the Edward Butynsky stuff?
I think it's boring.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, they're boring in a way, you know, it's formal.
Yeah.
It's formal, and then what? And then beyond that,
yeah.
And it's nice, and you know, it looks good in a bank, in the office space, in a boardroom. You know, it doesn't hurt. It's, you're far away. You don't smell things. You know.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very concise review. You weren't here specifically for Photo London. You're going to be doing a bit of teaching, aren't you? What are you going to be? What kind of wisdom are you going to be imparting to the students at LCC, London College of Communication?
Well, first of all, I don't know whether there's any wisdom in my pictures. Secondly, it will be basically a presentation of work and then throwing images at them, sort of a rough ride through my career.
Right.
Taking twists and turns.
Yeah.
You know, showing failures and detours and things, but basically trying to convey the message that photography is a great way of building your own character, whatever that means. And if you have a character, also being taken hopefully serious by the media or the market or the press or whoever your clients or your public is.
I mean, have you found that to be your kind of journey, that it's helped you to, you know, discover your character?
Well, maybe we should replace character with personality.
Right.
I mean, I dropped out of school. I never studied, never went to university. For me, the university was always the road. And then I surrounded myself with books. And so one subject led to the other. It's basically an observation of the world in fragments.
That's really interesting to hear that you sort of didn't have much formal education, because hearing you speak and seeing the work and hearing you talk about it, you know, it's so clear that you're, you know, incredibly well read in terms of history. And I know that history is essentially your overriding interest, your theme in a way. But most of that's come from just, you know, you're an autodidact, basically. You've just read. Is that basically how it's gone?
Well, autodidact. Self-learned means, you know, formal education. But in photography, I learned photography at the School of Arts in Zurich. You know, I'm from the stable of Werner Bischoff, René Bury, sort of from that humanistic thing. So that was my formal education in photography.
Yeah. But in terms of your general education, yeah, I'm thinking.
It was just curiosity, asking, looking at books, you know, trying to understand before I photograph something, to understand what I was looking at and how it relates to the next thing I would photograph. And as time went by, things didn't become easier but more complicated.
So on that subject of your sort of early years then, where did you grew up in Switzerland?
Yeah.
So what kind of a kid were you?
Well, I didn't like to play soccer. So I rather...
But you weren't bookish either at that stage. I mean, what happened with dropping out of school and all that?
I wasn't bookish, but I drew and I wrote down notes. I just read a couple of this juvenile nonsense, discovering here and there, you know, a phrase which would be worthwhile to review and look at carefully. What did I mean? So I always wrote, put down notes, kept on diaries and things like that.
But what stopped you from sort of going on to continue your formal education, to do a degree or whatever?
Well, I felt, you know, that's not... I mean, it's difficult to say at that age. You just feel what you receive in school is not what you want to know. You know that real life is outside there and you're hungry for life, you know. And I felt I want to do something and see what I'm doing. I want to have a result right away.
Right.
You know, so that I want to be responsible for what I do and ask. The challenge is I don't want to be challenges being thrown out by teachers who throw them at every year the same challenges, you know, and until they are diluted to mere nonsense. I wanted to go out. I wanted to travel, basically. I had a longing for traveling.
You certainly have fulfilled that over the years, and we'll get more into it. But when did the photography become a thing initially then? Do you remember that your initial interest, when that kind of kicked in?
Well, my father was a technician and sort of spent all his life looking at car engines from the 1940s. He drove a car until he was 93. And he built himself a replica Leica and had built himself a darkroom and an enlarger. And sort of he got me interested in photography. And from the moment I entered the photo class here at the School of Arts in Zurich, I knew that's going to be the thing. From that moment until today, where I'm sitting here, I think I've not lost one day of being bored.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Instantaneous.
Well, except maybe 2 or 3 weeks of fashion shooting.
That's not a bad record, considering. I mean, I guess when you've had a long career, you know, one of the interesting questions I think that comes up for me a lot on the podcast is, how do you sustain the enthusiasm? How do you keep that passion alive? But that, for you, that just comes naturally, does it?
Well, you know, you mentioned before history is my great subject, so I never have a problem of looking at the subject. It's not, you know, I'm not looking under my armpit to find a subject, or into my navel, or looking at myself. That can also be you know, a question for a life, you know. I mean, I like the work of Sophie Kahl and you know, and people like this, but for me, the world is too interesting than to stay at home and, you know, and arrange things to be photographed.
And so, I mean, guess was the photography in a way, you've mentioned your kind of fascination with travel. Was the photography the excuse, the convenient excuse for doing that, as it were?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. If you stick around at an editor's office, say, look, I have to go to Kashmir now. He doesn't know where Kashmir is and all that. You know, you go on his nerves as long as possible. And say, okay, take an advance and leave. Go. You know, so that was, I found out in the 90s at least, today is different. But you know, then again, you know, the reportages and the assignments were just part of my research towards a book. And my editors at the magazines, like Do Magazines, for instance, they knew that. They knew that if I would propose a story, it would come from the research I would have done for a book. And hence it had some, I had given some thoughts to it.
Right. So, yeah, you could bring a little bit more depth to it, yeah, maybe, by having done that research.
Yeah.
But also as a way to, therefore, use an assignment as a kind of way to continue with a personal project, as it were.
Yeah, that? Absolutely. The assignments in the best, in the 90s until the early 2000s, the assignments were, of course, they helped to pay the expenses, to complement what grants or publishers' advances. And then, of course, they were the first step of publication. And, you know, from the assignment, because I had shot the assignment in view of the book, there were always two or three images which would come into the edit of the book.
I think your first book was shot in Greece, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So what took you to Greece? What made you interested in that as a place to explore?
Well, I started that when I was still in school. And as I said, you know, being from the stable of Bischoff, it was really sort of, you know, with a European education, Eurocentric education, normally you would go to Greece. And I trained my eye and my technique, darkroom technique and exposure with, there were sort of some measures and values had been decisively established in marble or statues. So I found that a formidable exercise, field of exercise, and I'm pretty sure that spending a day or 2 days in the Acropolis Museum or in the National Museum, photographing sculptures helped me to understand the human being, and I strongly believe that sort of experience I got then helped me later to catch the right moment in a dense situation where people were involved to get expressions and gestures and all that. So.
And was it the sort of ancient Greeks and the history of that region that fascinated you, or were you very much sort of more preoccupied with the present, or was there a combination of those?
Well, I would say what brought me to Greece was certainly an interest in where does Europe come from, parts of it, not everything, but parts of it, and then of course trying to link the past with the present. Trying to see how things present days are still influenced by past things, but at the same time I was already then looking beyond the current national borders. I was in Istanbul, I was in Turkey, and I read Alexander, and that already brought me to Afghanistan. I had to wait another 20 years until or 15 years until I would eventually get there, but it was always beyond the borders. I always had these amazing things that looking the whole thing, if possible. Yeah.
And I guess the desire to visit these places came as a result of the books that you'd been reading, or was it the other way around, as it were? When you get to a place, you want to steep yourself in that by seeking out those works of of writing.
Well, I assume it was vice versa. It was both. And I had this sort of, my grandfather had been traveling in the East and being in Southeast Asia in the 10s and the 20s and all that. So I brought back old photographs from the Great Wall, you know, sort of things I inspired when I was a kid, you know, which sort of infused me or intoxicated.
Yeah. Well, you went to the Great Wall. That was one of the, I guess, the next things you did. You had a kind of epic journey. What inspired the idea for doing that?
Well, I would say that was, again, sort of the inspiration must have been come as I was a kid looking at these old pictures. But then as we were working on the book, on my first book, it hadn't been published yet. My publisher, Thomas Naira, took me out for dinner, and to my surprise, he said, I think we should think about your next book. You know, and as a young photographer, anxiously awaiting your first book, basically, you know, your mouth stays open, and you say, well, you have to think. And at that moment, you say, well, maybe The Great Wall, you know. And he snaps that moment and said, well, I can see that as a book.
Right.
Now, it was, of course, an absurd idea.
You sort of pulled it out of the air almost.
I leaned out of the window
too
far, and I couldn't get myself back. So then looking at things, it was clear it's a forbidden journey. It's not possible. Nobody had done it. It was China, a different China than today.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, we should reiterate that it was a very different situation back then. It was very closed. Place.
It was a closed place. You were not allowed to travel as a so-called FIT, foreign independent traveler. You were allowed to take trains and planes from the provincial capitals, but the Great Wall ran across the country. So it was really a literally forbidden journey, 8 months with a lot of gear, with a 4 or 5 inch camera and all that. You know, it
was really
19th century thing.
Yeah, you didn't make it any easier for yourself by your choice of format.
Well, it was really sort of probably it was one of the last adventures to be done in the East. It was a John Thompson-esque thing. And of course, I had looked at John Thompson's book from the 1860s.
What's that?
John Thompson, the great Scottish photographer,
right.
China, an illustration of its people, and the River Min, 2 volumes. You know, one of these great photographic adventures, one of the leading British, English photographers
mm-hmm.
of the 19th century. And I thought to take a 4 or 5 inch camera, it was a big themes, a big topic, so I need a big camera.
Right,
basically.
yeah.
That was the logic behind it.
And the plan was essentially what, to travel the full length of the wall? Was that the idea?
Well, that was the idea, but within that comes a caveat, you know. The entire wall, there's no entire wall. First of all, there are many walls built over 2,000 years, and it's a network of walls. So my ambition was not to start there where the Ming Wall begins at the sea coast and then the Jiayuguan, but to go to the North Korean border where earlier walls had started and go as far into the Taklamakan as I could, following the Han Great Wall from the 2nd century BC, including, you know, side tracks of the wall and as much as possible. So,
And I mean, the wall, I guess, was a sort of device, really, you know, a way of what, just exploring China as a place? Or what was the kind of overriding theme of the project?
Well, it was basically reconstructing the idea Great Wall, the first emperor's idea. I had to restrain myself very much of looking left and right the wall because of all the logistic nightmare and the psychological nightmare, all the barriers and checkpoints and things and hiding and, you know, camouflage and sneaking around checkpoints and all these things. So even refilling, you know, the car with fuel was a problem because you're not allowed as a passenger to go into the petrol station. You stay outside on the street. Now, sometimes it was very cold, but that was one thing. But all of a sudden, you stand outside in China. Then you were surrounded by dozens of people, among them the 2 people from party officials, and here you had the problem already. So it was staying invisible with that kind of gear and being in places where they hadn't seen a foreigner before. So it was, you can imagine, it was difficult. So I saw many, many situations and things where I would have liked to take pictures, but I had to be very disciplined not to risk the overall enterprise
right.
for an image. There were three or four instances where it happened, where I was really lucky, and in Yungang, in the coal mining district, and for instance, and those are other places. But that exercising this discipline also helped me later working in Afghanistan with the Taliban.
Mm. And you know, how did you sort of deal with your own kind of barriers, as it were, and the challenges, I suppose, you know, both physical and mental of that trip? Are you good in your own company? Do you deal with it, that kind of isolation well?
Well, at that point, you know, yeah, there was no cell phone, no email and all that. So once you're away from, you know, provincial capitals, there was basically no communication. I didn't communicate for weeks with anybody, just writing letters. Then the company were drivers and translators, confined to hotel rooms somewhere in the middle of nowhere for 2 weeks is not nice, especially if every day you have to report to the Office of Alien Entries and Exit, as it was called, to write self-critical letters. But again, that was a very Chinese thing to do. Physically, I was younger, fitter. Psychologically, I think I paid a price, as I found out later. But at that moment, to get the team together, to keep on going from one tower to the next, to the end. You know, once I was on the wall, there was no way back. You know, so
what was the price that you found out later?
Well, you know, the price was sort of I found out what I can endure.
Right.
So, but
a good thing, a useful thing to discover.
It's a good thing to start. You could have been nicer as a team, but on the other hand, maybe the work would look different.
Yeah. Right.
So you never know. So.
Yeah. But in terms of your sort of working practice, I guess, you know, maybe it hasn't changed that much since those days. I know you mainly shoot with a medium format camera now, but you and the 35mm, I think. But how did you go about establishing some kind of a personal, you know, voice, as it were?
Well, once I'd done the Great Wall, I felt now I'm ready to look at other people's despair and emergencies.
Mm.
You know, so that's when I went into the deltas and then starting looking at the topic of climate change, and there you sort of my well-being didn't play a role anymore, you know, because I was trying to find out, to let the people speak through my pictures. It wasn't about, not about me. I mean, the Great Wall thing was about the wall as well as it was about me, who was able to, I challenged the People's Republic of China, you know. And I got my thing together, and it was exhibited in the Forbidden City a couple of years later, you know. But looking at people then in dire conditions, really, that was another thing.
So this was essentially about water, wasn't it? This was in South and Southeast Asia,
yeah.
And it was an examination of, I guess, you know, what happens when water is scarce.
Well, it was that, but basically it was, as you know, in the late 80s, sort of the spectre of climate change started to become. So I wanted to go and see who then are these damned of the earth who will, you know, will first be hit when the polar ice starts melting as a consequence of global warming, and not wait until they are lost. So that was in the deltas of Southeast Asia, of the great rivers.
I mean, in terms of people's awareness of climate change, that was really quite early on, I would have thought, you know, considering even now, you know, we've got a climate change denier in the White House. There's still people who aren't taking it seriously. And in those days, I imagine it was possibly, you know, much less common to find people who were aware of all that.
Absolutely. And also that helped me to define my photographic language, and also the book, which we did. The book should be a contribution to the awareness, and not a Salgard-esque celebration of beauty in despair. sort of it was meticulously planned, looking at the cycles, how agriculture work, festivities, things related to water, also including, of course, cyclones, floods and erosion, the silent calamity. It was early on, but the book was supposed to be a political statement and not a celebration of photography.
And you know, did you think about how best, you know, about whether really a photo book can disseminate that that message, you know, as widely as perhaps it, you know, deserves to be disseminated? I guess this is the old question of, you know, how much good can we really do as photographers? And that is very much about how you choose to get the work out there. Did you think about that stuff?
Well, the book, of course, has a lot of text. So if you open a spread, you see 3-4 pictures, but it's always a mini reportage with substantial text. The pictures are placed in the context of ecological facts or political facts. What happens? Who are the people whom you see in the picture? What are they doing? It's not just showing themselves. And I don't believe in the phrase that, you know, a picture is better than 10,000 words or 1,000 words.
Yeah, no, I was thinking this. In fact, we'll get onto it, but you've also done more recent work about glaciers and how, you know, that the glaciers disappearing is obviously a major symptom of climate change. And, you know, and they're beautiful images, but I don't really know what I'm looking at, if you see what I mean. Like, I guess as most of us wouldn't. I need that context. I need that caption that tells me what it is that I'm seeing. But I guess we'll talk. Obviously, we'll talk more about that. But were you had a long relationship with Thames and Hudson? Were they the ones who published the Delta book?
Yeah, they published all my books,
including the Greek one.
Yep.
Great. So I guess you've had, you know, I guess because they're a big publisher, has that had an impact on you know, the number of books you've managed to be able to sell, do you think? I mean, are they and you know, having the wider distribution that a big publisher can bring, has that affected the number of people who've been able to see the work, do you think?
Well, I think it's strange, you know, because each of my book is different. And over 25 years, 5 books is not that many. But the great thing with Thames and Hudson was sort of that they made me feel an author and having a voice, and they gave me a place, and they treated my work with dignity and competence and careful from the beginning to the end. And I felt like in this great neighborhood of not only these great photographers, but also in the neighborhood of great architects and artists and all that. So the whole ecosystem, as I could call it, you know, influenced me and I think helped me to shape my voice and my character. I had a home, basically, which is incredibly rare and an incredible privilege. And I was, every time when I set out on a reportage destined to become a part of a book we had decided before, I you know, I felt responsible. I didn't want to disappoint, you know.
Yeah, so it kind of gave you that added incentive in a way.
Yeah, now regarding sales, I have no idea. I don't know, you know, authors never know the print run of their books. If you happen at the printers, then you might see a note on the machine, you know. But certainly my books are not easy to sell, because if it's a Great Wall of China, it's black and white. It's straightforward photography. It's not color and a travel book. You know, if it's on the glaciers, you don't see the summits of the mountains. It's not the Reinhold Messmer. It's, you don't know what you're looking at. So I think my books in the Thames and Hudson program, they are sort of a bit stubborn, you know, and need to be carried or the help of other books to be sold. And I think that's what only a publisher with a large wide program can do.
Right. Yeah, because I guess they're going to have some books which they know are not going to sell very large numbers, and then they're going to be offset against the ones that are going to sell big numbers. Yeah.
Yes, but I knew, I realized that when Delta was published and I got a letter from Thomas Neurath, and including a clipping from the Financial Times listing that book among the best photo books of that year, and saying this is a visual j'accuse, referring to the Dreyfus quote. So I thought, oh, okay, that's where my book probably comes in this whole orbit of Thames and Hudson.
So I guess was that your initial interest in environmental issues that, you know, had kicked off from that project, from the Delta project, I mean?
Well, even... And when I photographed the Great Wall of China, I came through the Ordos Desert. And the Great Wall is an invasion of man-made work into the natural landscape. And in the Ordos Desert, the building of the wall had a direct impact on the ecosystem of the Ordos Desert. It's in the Yellow River Bend, whereas, first of all, the Chinese tried to burn down the grassland in order to take away the incentive of the nomads driving their sheep into it. But also by building the wall, they chopped down all the trees to make scaffolding for the rammed earth of which the wall is built there. So that was my first, and this problem started 600 years ago and it still continues, the desertification of northern China. And then, of course, the deltas. Yes, because I saw how these people deal with constant disasters, and they are much better prepared probably than we are to disasters. Now the Swiss, they start realizing our mountains collapse on top of our heads, and we are totally unprepared for. We need to retreat in an orderly manner, but until we do this, it will take some more accidents. And then of course Central Asia, the work I did on Central Asia, traveling through the eye of history, looking at the deserts of Inner Asia and all the disasters coming from the planned economy years of the Soviet Union and the Aral Lake and the rivers there, and looking again at history, and that's why I use this word, my work lies in the history of places, because the history of places explain the places, but also the places explain then the history of the climate.
Yeah, so it's kind of been a thread really all the way through, regardless of where you've been, the whole, you know, ecological question. Well, let me read this quote. My methods are storytelling, and as things evolve in the course of my work, history telling. I accord primacy to my objects. Consequently, I impose no limits on the possibilities of the medium. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. As I said, the Great Wall, I used a 4-5-inch camera. In the deltas, there was no use of using a tripod because you stand in the water yourself. So I try not to impose a view, my view, which sort of puts a label on me, my style, in the scene of photography, that I can be recognized across my style. I liked always the idea of doing a book, going away, and then doing something else. And as it happened, I would meet people said, "Oh, you're the guy who did the Great Wall of China." I thought that can't be the same person. So I feel quite happy in finding out first which medium and what approach I'm going to use. With the glaciers, I had to learn taking pictures from the helicopter, right? And it looks very good once you are above ground, but it can also look very boring at some point. So as I'm shooting analog with a Hasselblad, analog, 12 pictures, flying is not cheap. So people would say you have to do a lot of pictures. I used my lighting meter, my Luna 6. I tried to slow down, to keep also not to get carried away by the possibilities of, but looking carefully at things, and that's where the science came in. I went to scientists and worked with scientists, glaciologists, who told me, look, when you fly this route, look at this glacier, there's something happening there. Not that I would photograph it, but seeing it helped me to focus the picture, and thus I had the guarantee that, or the hope, that my picture would also be of value in a couple of years, in 50 years or in 100 years, because I had not missed the one striking factor which relates to the problem of climate change and glacier collapse.
Let's stick with it on that subject then, since we're into it. So first of all, fundamentals, what is a glacier?
Well, a glacier is an organism. It's an organism. Probably where we sit now, there was a glacier at some point during the last glacial maximum.
And we're talking about an expanse of ice, basically, are we?
Expansive ice. And I was looking at not at sea ice, but at land ice in alpine regions.
Okay. And the sort of the reduction of these areas is obviously a major a kind of canary in the coal mine, as it were, of climate change. So is that, you finished that project or is it ongoing?
It's finished as a book and as an exhibition. But this summer I'll try to go and do something in Afghanistan on glaciers.
Yeah. So what, you know, on a scale of sort of 1 to 10, as far as optimism goes, if 1 is we're fine and 10 is we're screwed, where do you sit on that? On that line, as far as, you know, the future goes, you know, in terms of environmental disaster?
Well, I mean, a glacier has a couple of aspects. Basically, it's a reservoir of fresh water. So the alpine regions and ecosystems which depend on water, they are going to have a major problem. Then the sea ice or the polar ice, which melts, will rise sea level. We are not talking about Bangladeshi societies now being endangered, but whole cities, Jakarta or New York or Miami, being endangered. Then what we lose with the ice, we lose the climate archive. The climate in the ice course, we have a climate archive. We see what happened since the Industrial Revolution, the anthropogenic emissions. If we lose the climate archive, we lose in data information which helps us to look into the future, what could happen, to
predictions.
So that's why we cannot save our glaciers. Switzerland will be... the Alps will be green in 80 years. So in countries like this, we are a skiing nation still, we consider us, and glaciers play a major part in our economy, but also it's about our nation and identity. We have to invent something new, and people are not prepared to recognize this fact, or only the past couple of years starting to realize that we're going to have a major identical crisis if we look at up glaciers and see darkening peaks.
So what you seem to be saying is that there are certain things which are almost certainly going to happen, whether, you know, regardless of what,
yes, they
what
will
we
happen,
now do.
They are unstoppable. The process is unstoppable. We do not talk about glaciers retreating. We talk about glaciers collapsing.
Right. Okay. Well, that's a bit depressing.
Well, you can say in 10, 15, 20,000 years, glaciers will come again. We are still in the Pleistocene ice age, in an interglacial, which is usually a warmer period within an ice age. But this one has become, we have really sort of boosted a bit ourselves.
So again, you're kind of looking at it in terms of the whole of the cycles of history in a way. You're bringing your kind of historian perspective to it. I'm just thinking about getting through the next, you know, I don't know, well, my life and hopefully my kids' life. But yeah, and While the Fires Burn is the title of that project. Yeah. Where does the title come from?
Well, the title comes from, obviously, well, it says, as While the Fires Burn, a Glacier Odyssey. The main thing, While the Fires Burn, I allude to not only the big fires of, you know, of the petrol industry, but also of the millions and millions of small fires which peasants all over the world, in the majority world, have to burn because their governments are unwilling to organize themselves and provide electricity.
Hmm. And there's a film being made as well, isn't there, of your well, about you, I guess, about you shooting the thing, a documentary. I think it's called Beyond the Obvious.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Beyond the Obvious, basically, it's a film about my, I would say, life and work. And it takes the work on Wildfires Burn as sort of a narrative thread. But in looking at the making of this project, or the end phase of this project, it looks into the rear mirror and tries to find out where do my methods come from, my approaches, etc. So all five large projects are being touched in that film. The idea came from a TV small documentary from a German TV broadcasting station, who did something when I photographed the Ruwenzori Mountains, the glaciers of the Ruwenzori in Uganda. So the cameraman and editor who flew with us, he had the idea to do a film about the whole project, but it had been advanced so much. Then the director who took the book over, and once he got familiar with my work, he said, let's do a documentary about your life.
He's also Swiss, right?
He's Swiss, yeah.
So, yeah, what did you learn about, you know, that, I guess, the necessary process of reflection that, you know, you have to go through if someone's asking you about your work? You know, did you come to any insights that you hadn't had before about your own practice and yourself, I suppose?
Well, I found out, I mean, you set out knowing only few things. Then you start working, you learn more, you acquire knowledge, and you think, and then all of a sudden you realize knowing more doesn't make things easier because you see things more connected. So that's why at the end you look at something as a whole thing, and if somebody suggests you a subject, then you immediately see the implication it has to others, or the influences it exercises onto other themes. So that doesn't make you an easy partner for assignments, because people then are always afraid, even for conferences, you know, they can't keep your quotes limited to narrow yes or no's. Right. You know, I always have to go in circles to come to conclusion. But
yeah, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Well, we've got to talk about Central Asia, because you know that's been a huge part of your life and travels and work, I suppose. And I think it was the 90s when you first kind of started to explore that region, wasn't it? What took you to that part of the world?
Well, as I've said, Greece already brought me in touch with Alexander, who marched halfway to India. The Great Wall brought me halfway to Europe. So in between the two was a gap. The gap nobody knew since ancient times. Where does Europe start? Where does Asia begin? The different concepts since the ancient geographers. At the same time, it's a sphere of influence which I knew or had thought it's going to be a decisive area, and if you look at things today, we see it clearly. The influence in the old times between the Arabs, the Chinese, and the Europeans, later then by the Russians or the Soviets and British India, etc., etc. It's an area, the concept of which is unclear to most people. The English father of geopolitics, Mackinder, he called it the pivot of history. Mm. He who controls this inland controls the periphery because of the resources and the accesses and the transport corridors. And that's what's playing out today.
Mm-mm. And I'm wondering if, you know, at the time when you first went, because obviously your travels there have straddled 9/11. That's the kind of, you know, this kind of pivotal moment in the history of that region and the world in as well. But, you know, is there any way in which you could have foreseen that kind of thing happening, that, you know, that it was somehow predictable if you understand the history of that region and its relationship with the rest of the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, take the three British Anglo-Afghan wars. Look at history. Earlier history, the Timurid. Look at the Mongols. Look at the Mughals. It's always about craving out an empire there. You have natural borders. Geography plays a distinctive role with corridors, mountain barriers, and rivers and deserts. It was always a fight between the oasis population and the nomads. And from the moment you have empires playing the great game, people in between there were always instrumentalized. And when 9/11 happened, again, it was the foresight of the publisher. We didn't for a second think we have to push out the book now, because in my perspective, or in the Central Asian perspective, towers collapse all the time. That was the history, right? So it confirmed the thesis I had, and things became more complicated. But actually, already 7 years before, 6 years before, you could see fermenting in the Pamir and in Afghanistan. I remember 96 in Tajikistan, the Pamir on the border to Afghanistan. We went with these ruby miners, and they were at the same time on the other side of the border. The Taliban had taken a Kabul, and we could see Russians shipping weapons to the Tajik forces, the former enemy, beyond the knowledge of the world media, because remember, the wall had come down, history had stopped existing, according to Fukuyama. The West was on the party. We had won, in parentheses, the Cold War. Nobody was interested. Everybody was interested in making money and building a financial, a global financial structure and celebrating globalization, which would exclude more people than include, as we know today. And in Central Asia, you could exactly see this, because you could see the fiber cable running along the old Silk Road only, but it connected Frankfurt and Shanghai, but it excluded all these oasis cultures and economies, which in earlier times could be suppliers of that trade. So there would be anger, obviously, and then you just need two, three fatal political errors, and then the whole place was on fire, and it still is.
Should photographers have a better grasp of the historical context of the kind of places that they go and photograph, do you think?
Well, it's not up to me to say what photographers should have. I'm very sure that the photographer who is not interested in current politics, in the history, he is able to produce telling images, because he just has the feeling, the gut feeling, the eye heat, the instinct. He just knows it. What I see today is that those photographers, in my eyes, who produce solid, relevant work, they do not come from art schools. They have either studied the classics, like for instance, Tim Hetherington, or politics. If you want to do a story on blood diamonds, the formation in art school is not helpful. But the formation on world economics is helpful.
It would be helpful to have read something about the history of the region in which those diamonds have been produced, for instance, rather than, as you say, studying, art history or something. But that's what I mean. I think, maybe we all need to think more about really educating ourselves fully if we're going to go off and take pictures in places which we really don't know too much about.
Well, we need to listen.
Yeah.
We need to go see for ourselves, and then obviously we meet people and we have to listen to them. We should forget about our preconcepts which we carry. We go, we inform ourselves at home, and then we forget what we have read and we go there. And this will eventually change the concepts we have or modify concepts, and we need to listen to what people have to say to us and to find a way of building their information into the way we see things.
Well, I think you've said that it's important to you to see things from as many different perspectives as possible.
Yeah.
Has that always been the case for
you?
Well,
that's something you learn. I mean, people sometimes ask me, but these dangerous places, have you ever been in life danger? I said, I might have, but I don't know, because the people who took me there and brought me out, if they said it's time to leave, then I said, okay, fine with me.
Mm-mm.
Because you always have, even if you're informed very well, once you're on the place, you only understand 25% of what's going on. The rest, you're not being told. People protect you from it or don't want to give it to you because they still don't trust you, even if you try to be open. So you have to know that you always scratch on the surface, and you're lucky if you bring back from every assignment one or two pictures which sort of go a little bit deeper.
It was really interesting, I think, as you've said about, you know, those countries that you were interested in, the five Central Asian republics, the stands. I won't list them. I can, Daniel, I promise, but I know you can too. But, you know, they didn't, you know, at the time it was a fascinating time when everything changed and, you know, communism collapsed, and they didn't really know what to do with this independence that they suddenly had. And you know, should they move towards democracy, you know, or should they continue with despots? And also, you know, what were they going to do about Islam, which had been suppressed, obviously? Were those the things that you were sort of trying to explore as you went around that region to take pictures? Was that something you tried to actually kind of talk about in the work, as it were?
Well, it was something you encountered, especially in Uzbekistan, you know, where the IMU, Independent Movement of Uzbekistan, came for. They were collaborating with the Taliban, and of course, these despots tried to suppress them and use it all as a pretext to lock away dissidents and torture dissidents. And of course, they were helpful hands to the Bush administration. So it was. In Kashmir, the story is more complicated. In Iran, the story is more complicated. But it's also the adjoining regions of the five stans. I mean, the Chinese used the pretext of the Uyghurs being Islamists in order to continue their cultural genocide on the Uyghur culture under the pretext of fighting terrorism. So you really could see how world politics were playing out in very faraway regions, which the people had no idea where they are, and that at the cost of the local population.
Mm.
To photograph that directly, it was more complicated.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, how, you know, when you're dealing with you know, the business of trying to photograph not just one country, but a vast chunk of the world. when it comes to the actual kind of nuts and bolts of, you know, what am I going to point my camera at? You know, how do you go about deciding on what you're going to shoot, basically? You know, what specific areas of the story do you want to tackle?
Well, as you travel, you see... Maybe you see a kiosk somewhere in Uzbekistan and it has a sign with Uncle Sam forcing you to buy American cigarettes. You see that and you say, well, that could be useful at one point. And then you collect images. As itself, the picture doesn't... It's nice and it's rusty and it looks good and the chromes are nice. But as an image itself, it doesn't say anything. But it might be useful once you start compiling the book and putting the chapters together,
right?
Because then juxtaposed to another image, it might say something. And
right.
Then it was also that book where I introduced the text work as a art form, where I could convey things which the image could not convey.
Right.
And I found that very useful to use.
So this is about the limitations of photography,
yes,
really, as a medium,
basically.
And how.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think I agree with you. The people who go on about pictures ought to be able to, you know, stand on their own. I just think it is bullshit. Tell us about your writing then. So you obviously you're, you know, photographers. Some photographers are do a bit of writing. You've done a fair bit. Well, how did the writing become part of the process for you?
Well, it started with the idea that I should write chapter introductions to that book, Traveling to the Day of History. So as I started writing, it became more and more. And of course, I wrote it in German. And then all of a sudden it was clear that these texts can't be used for the Thames and Hudson book. So a German publisher stepped in and said, look, okay, so this is your artist book or your photography book. Now write me a book about the book about Central Asia. It became a 1,000-page book, which was a terrible process to go through and come out again. It just happened. I didn't want it. I wasn't looking for it.
In what way was it terrible? Just because it was hard work?
Because writing a book was more isolation more than the Great Wall was.
Oh God, yeah, I can imagine. Except you're stuck in a room.
I'm stuck in a room, and I have to deal with 3,000 years of history. and how do I put that together? And it became a funny book, though, and which opened completely new areas and all that. But it was sort of a side process. But then for the book with photographs, I introduced this idea of using text work, say like Richard Long uses it, only they are not in his spirit, but I try to convey the context to some images in a text work, which in doing this text work, I was forced to be straightforward and concise and everything in capital letters. And also it had typographically to look good. So I sort of imposed on myself a strict set of rules not to embark on another writing journey. And that was very helpful in that book, and also used it again for the book on glaciers.
Was there any way in which you could then apply some of those rules back into your photography? I mean, in terms of setting rules for yourself, or do you do that anyway?
Well, some friends of mine, they once told me that I only take a picture once I have the caption. So that's not quite true. I mean, when I see a picture, I try to take it regardless whether I can supply it afterwards with a text or not. And sometimes it's better to leave a picture stand on its own. But if you want to relate complex stories, as it was the case in Central Asia, I found it really a useful tool to expand my ways of expression by text works.
Yeah. Well, it continues to be a complicated part of the world and a complicated situation, doesn't it? I don't know if there's ever going to be any resolution to it. It seems so multifaceted, and the issues seem to be so entrenched, you know, as you say, for thousands of years. Have you got any conclusions about what should be done?
Well, what I've seen in the past two, three years, when I was there again, that the Chinese are doing what they had promised to do when I was back in the 80s, 70s, when I was sitting in these hotel rooms, reading these five-year master plans in 87, that until the year 2000, they would highways across the whole country. Now they are building the highway down the Karakorum Highway, which in 2001 was a dangerous road. Now it's basically a highway. They don't obey the Feng Shui anymore like they did with the Great Wall. They just blow away mountains and tunnel. The Pakistanis are not capable or have difficulties to do it. The Chinese do it, the difficult jobs for them. They tunnel the Karakorum, which is earthquake prone. To get access to the Gavdar port. So basically they imply they are the driving force now. Everybody is joining, of course. I mean, what happens in the Korean Peninsula has also to do, how do the Koreans get their cars to Rotterdam? It's easier through this piece of North Korea and then put it on Chinese trains and down Rotterdam. So everybody has to play the game. The Chinese don't ask, they just do it.
Right.
Create facts on the ground.
Right.
And they will eventually, if ever anybody will be able to bring peace to Afghanistan and the Chinese.
Uh-huh.
And the interesting thing was during these 15 years, we have spent billions and billions of dollars on contractors. And basically, the NATO and the US forces have protected the Chinese entrepreneurs getting the concessions on the minerals. The Chinese are neighbors. And if Afghanistan is ever going to have a railroad, the Chinese will build it. And it will connect Lhasa to Kabul, because you don't stop a train in Lhasa. You build it to go further.
Right, okay. Yeah, interesting. Like, have you got anything in the pipeline to, if you pardon the pun, once the glacier thing will be ongoing to some extent, but do you have any big plans for new projects?
Well, I'm still looking at some things overlapping, glaciers overlapping, earlier subjects, but I keep on looking at the Horn of Africa. And Yemen, of course, which is a disaster, which is so obscene, you know, what's happening there.
Yeah.
And so very difficult place to go to get access to, because those people who are responsible for the disaster are not interested.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about what's happening in Yemen, because I think a lot of people don't even know. It's a very kind of underpublicized part of, you know, what's going on.
It's a multi-layered armed conflict, from between tribal conflicts to geopolitics, and it's about the influence of Saudi Arabia in that part of the world, and of course it includes the opposite side of Somalia, Djibouti, and all this part, and it's a part of the Mideast politics which haven't been benefited from the Trump administration.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense, because it's pretty much the only bit of the world you haven't explored. So, you know, it's almost like get involved with that bit, and Daniel, and then that's pretty much the whole planet covered.
Oh, no. There's whole of, I mean, in Africa, I've been
Central America and South America. But
yeah, Peru. I was in Peru, and in Africa, Rwanda and Uganda and all the rest.
Okay, so you've already.
But I'm not doing the country for the alphabet. So
no,
I'm not
I know.
I prefer to go back and keep and exercise a long-term observation, because if you're looking at something over a very long time, you also eventually also learn about the other things.
In terms of sort of, I guess, very practical things, earning a living, that's always an interesting topic for photographers. Do you get assignments from editorial clients, or, you know, how does it work for you in terms of your income pie chart?
Well, the assignments were a vital cornerstone in the 90s on my books on the deltas and on Central Asia. The book on glaciers was not an assignment, was not practicable for assignment.
Sure.
So
you had
to fund it. Grants and funds
and
investment, hopefully on return as with print sales. But I'm in the lucky position to have produced a lot of vintage prints from assignments, because it was a time where I didn't deliver files but made decent prints, especially when for assignments for Doom magazine, you know, wanted to be really, which made well printing, you made good silver gelatin prints, so these are vintage prints now,
right?
So I tried to sell these, make an income from these, or part of the income, and then from new work which is produced now, especially from the glaciers, which is acquired by museums or corporate collections.
Right, right.
Large,
so that is
large case print.
It's almost like we've come full circle, because we started out talking about Photo London, which is, of course, all, as you say, Vanity Fair, all about that process. But is that actually a very important element of your income?
It's very, very important. It's existential.
Yeah.
Existential, yes, absolutely. Yeah. And you depend on regular buyers and who have followed you and stayed.
Loyal
to you over time. Yeah. So this is very, very vital.
And you've stayed loyal to the analog. You're obviously not anyone who's going to switch to digital anytime soon. I don't know if you even consider that proper photography.
No, I never considered it. I like printing. I'm happy to say I'm a good printer. And whatever exceeds sort of the sheet size, especially for thematic exhibitions, then I have people reproduce.
But you're committed to film as a you know, as your kind of chosen medium. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
What about Seven? You've joined Seven. I don't know when did you become part of Seven?
Last autumn in this landslide.
Yeah. So you're a very recent addition, as it were.
Yeah.
And how did that all unfold? Did you was that something you were looking for in your, you know, for your, well, I don't know, for whatever reason, were you looking to become part of a collective?
Well, I was part of Locat Photos, a small Swiss agency from the 90s, which was just too small a player to survive in the dying of species in the 2000s. But I knew Gary and Knight for a very long time and from Asia, and so we were friends. We had common friends, John Griffiths, Greg Davies, and other people. So and he was regularly coming to see me, and we discussed, and I was looking what Seven was doing. And then at one point, almost his phone call and say, "Hey, look, I think we have to, you know, I'm looking at Seven and doing it something. I think you should be part of it." And fine, you know. So that was it.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
Sort of.
Does it feel? Do you feel in a way that you've kind of joined a family to some extent? I don't want to be overly kind of sentimental about it, but you know, there is always that issue of that sense of isolation that, well, I guess we all, you know, you're kind of a one man band very much as a photographer. Is that part of it for you?
Well, it's first of all, joining Seven is very inspirational because, on terms of you look more carefully at what other people do, people who have been you were aware of, but once you are in the same group, you look at it more carefully. You have the personal encounter, and then together you are stronger in making a statement. And I think especially the education projects which we have are very important because the industry is so much in a change, and not only the industry, but the whole behavior towards images and the use it of images. I want to use the word photography in most of these cases. But so I think we, at a certain age, also you are obliged to convey your experience to younger people. And also consider that as very, I think the more interesting question I get from people half my age.
Right. And so you quite enjoy that dynamic that you're, you know, you've become at your sort of stage in your career, you're mentoring the kind of younger generation.
Absolutely. And I did that before I joined Seven
on a
sort of semi-official way of helping people, and they in turn work in my archive and do and do things for me, and so it's very gratifying also because it reminds me 2 days when I was younger and had some elder colleagues sharing their expertise and knowledge.
Well, it's what David Allen Harvey calls paying it back and paying it forward. You know, that's his way of explaining
correct.
That. So
that's correct.
Similar position.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad you're doing that, and it's great to meet you and chat properly, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. So thanks, Daniel, and I'll look forward to seeing all the other stuff that comes out in the future. I'll put references to all the various references that you've made that people won't have a clue what, you know, so I'll put links in the show notes so that we can actually see because you are obviously, you know, you're a very well-read person, and the references come thick and fast. Thank you, Daniel, I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Thanks, Ben.